The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Report from Europe. I'm Marek Hansel, the editor of Institutional Real Estate Europe. And with me today on the podcast, we have Simon Durkin. Simon is Global Head of Real Estate Research and Analytics at BlackRock. And Simon and I today are going to delve a little deeper into what BlackRock call mega forces. So five mega forces that BlackRock have identified, which are propelling real estate development and investment. And I think, Simon, if I'm correct, you and your colleagues sort of identified these last year. Is that right? And you sort of talk about these as big structural changes that affect investing, not just now, but into the long term.
Yeah. Hi, Marek, and hello to everybody. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the mega forces are more relevant in this cycle than they were in previous cycles, and particularly as we came out of the GFC. You know, what we saw then was largely a capital markets play that was fueled by cheap money and low interest rates, and hence demand for yield. I think it's very different this time as we try and align the cyclical opportunity of a turning point in the macro economy with those structural trend changes that we have a high conviction that we will see these drive sort of future performance and performance differentials.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point you make there, Simon, that it is a particularly different time now, this particular cycle, isn't it? Sort of almost unprecedented. But yeah, well, thanks for joining us, Simon. Great to have you on with us. I guess for our listeners, what we're going to do is sort of dive into all five of them as far as we can, given the time constraints on one podcast. But the first mega force, if you like, is demographic divergence. Obviously self-explanatory in one way, but could you tell us a bit more about that, Simon, and what particular demographics are catching your eye there at BlackRock?
Yeah, absolutely. Firstly, I think as we think about real estate markets in all parts of the world, in all cities and in all countries, that, you know, demand is ultimately being driven by people and how they consume real estate. Yeah, and this is obviously driving demand for logistics and retail. How people work is driving demand for office space and workplace facilities, and how they spend leisure time drives their demand for leisure facilities, and how they live, work and study drives demand for residential. But none of this is new, but I think often the divergent country and importantly the city level trends are changing our notion of what makes a strong location stand out from a lesser performing location. And when thinking about the global investing landscape, you know, at BlackRock we spend a lot of time thinking about these divergent trends in countries and in cities. And I think these demographic idiosyncrasies and their implications for the future value creation across sectors is absolutely critical to understand. If we think about Europe specifically, you know, Europe is typically characterized by having an aging population. And this will fundamentally alter the way we live, work, shop, and the way we interact with the built environment. And ultimately how we think about the sectoral impact in having to accept that real estate is changing. And that's the first, that's sort of the first thing that we all need to do is accept that this time it is quite different. If we look at the UK forecasts, you know, forecast population for people aged 65 plus is growing faster than any other age group. 2042 is forecast to be an additional 1.1 million people over the age of 80.
Wow.
And that's huge. Okay, so yes. You know, to keep pace with the with with demand for real estate, we need another almost 15,000 additional care home beds to be delivered per annum. Huge.
Right.
Compares with less than 4,000 that have been delivered per annum over recent years. So, you know, we're seeing a shortfall of almost 70%. But I think we should also think about, yes, we're living longer, but we're not necessarily living healthier lives. So I think medical advancements have been prolonging life, but isn't yet leading to us all living particularly healthier lives. And I think this will drive further demand for healthcare and asset classes in that healthcare space, which in turn will drive more demand for medical research facilities. So I think, you know, there are fundamentally correct demographic drivers behind many of the investment theses that we're currently pursuing. One other thing I would just add here, Marek, is that, you know, funding for retirement for maybe 20 plus years, it will be very expensive for people. And I think few of us expect a significant reduction in our lifestyle post-retirement. In fact, most people expect an uptick in their life, given more leisure time.
Right, more cruises.
Absolutely. Yeah, more golf courses, you know, more more hotels, more tourism. So I think that's really interesting to sort of follow through. So if post-retirement in 10 years time, you know, people are living for, say, on average 20 to 25 years, you know, that will have an impact on lending from the bank of mum and dad to children, given that they now have to actually use that capital or focus that capital on funding 20 to 25 years worth of retirement and ultimately leisure time. I guess where we will land on this is that we'll probably all find ourselves working a lot longer into our 60s than maybe we would ordinarily like, because our life expectancy is growing so quickly. But that's it. One end of that sort of demographic sort of spectrum. But I think there's also an interesting demographic trend around increasing number of students and student mobility. And this is very much sort of driving our conviction around student housing. And it's a conviction that we've had for several years now, but it's one that is still grounded in pretty strong data and trends. You know, student numbers in Europe continue to grow, and it's partly driven by that organic increase in that age cohort. But also, I think it's the increasing number of international students and student mobility. And by 2030, the number of 20 to 24 year olds in Europe is forecast to increase by 4.5%, which might not sound a massive number, but that's equivalent to 800,000 people, which is significant. And if we think about that alongside the growth in students from certain countries around the world, and particularly India and China, you know, the UK is expected to see an increase over the next 5 years of, you know, 120 to 130% from those countries alone. And that, I think, will continue to drive the demand supply imbalance that currently exists in most of those European cities that are attractive to mobile students from other parts of the world.
Right.
And I suppose, I mean, you know, I would focus a little bit on Europe there. But in certain niche sectors, we're also seeing emerging opportunities, and particularly around childcare centres, you know, where in the developed markets, you know, a greater proportion of women returning to work. You know, it's a key government policy to increase the workforce. Hence, demand for childcare is growing rapidly in order to support that workforce growth. And in fact, in Australia, you know, the cohort of under 15s, you know, is growing by sort of 10 to 15% by around 2040. And that's just indicating continuous demand for childcare centres, you know, in order for the government to increase the workforce. So, you know, these are demographic trends that will be quite slow to reverse. And why do we have high conviction around these? Well, demographic and population forecasts are relatively more robust than forecasts of maybe other other factors, given that there are only three variables that can really, yeah, they can really tip the balance here. It's births, it's deaths, and it's migration. And I guess it's that sort of migration piece and its links to politics and geopolitics, where I guess a lot of the uncertainty gets introduced. But we don't suddenly have more children from 1 year to the next, and we don't suddenly die more 1 year to the next.
No. Yeah, fascinating. Some of those figures, particularly the aging population around the UK, 1.1 million people over 80 by 2042. It's amazing, huge numbers. Okay, well, you've sort of touched a bit upon the second mega force, if you like, geopolitical fragmentation, Simon, and you sort of mentioned migration and what have you. And I was sort of just thinking, as you were talking about the student numbers and the aging population numbers, there's been a bit of resentment in some quarters, I guess, with sort of baby boomers hoarding all the equity and property and making renting and buying homes very difficult for young people in Europe. Do we also, with the geopolitical fragmentation, is that, from your perspective, is that to do with tension between nations and different regions, or is it a bit more nuanced than that?
I think we'll all accept that we live in a world of greater sort of geopolitical uncertainty today, certainly than we have for maybe any time over the past sort of 30 or so years. And a world characterized by greater volatility is a driver of uncertainty and hence, investor caution. So, it's never been more important than today to build resilience into portfolios, and one simple way of doing that is looking at sort of geographical diversification and diversifying country level risks into your overall strategy to try and impact to mitigate, I guess, the impact of those non-forecastable events. Also, it's important, I think, not to dismiss the perceived tail risks, because perceived tail risks have an increasing probability of happening and being termed a black swan event, when in actual fact many black swan events are only black swan events because they exist in the tail of probabilities and hence don't get any attention, are often dismissed and come as a surprise. So I think there is a danger in dismissing tail risks as something that's probably not going to happen. But geopolitical risks or geopolitical uncertainty is maybe the right way of phrasing it, is on the rise. And that international environment is becoming increasingly complex. It's those political tensions globally that are elevated and more widespread than they have been in the past, which have been exacerbated by the pandemic, been exacerbated by recent conflicts, and the concern that there might be wider contagion from these conflicts. But I think these have alerted us to the risks of globalization. And I think we have to try and bring this back to real estate. It's okay, well, what does this mean for real estate? Well, the global economy has evolved over the past 50 years, and so too the supply chains have also become more globalized and have been optimized for cost and been value engineered. And hence, supply chains pre-pandemic were incredibly dispersed globally. But then I think the vulnerabilities of globalization of supply chains were certainly highlighted by the pandemic, and they were added to by the blockage in the Suez Canal. No one saw that one. And also by the disruption caused by various conflicts around the world. So I think corporations now have started to reevaluate these supply chains and have become more conscious of the need to build resilience, maybe over short-term price optimization. So if we think about where we find ourselves in terms of the macro environment, we are in a period of high inflation. It's coming down and it's heading in the right direction. But the drivers behind this inflation have been supply side drivers, largely driven by the reopening of economies post pandemic. And if we follow this thought trail through to what this might mean for real estate, then, I think the challenge, and an example of where this has been challenging, has maybe been in the dominance of South Korea, Taiwan and China, and the manufacture of semiconductors and chips. Okay, and chips, not just really important for our cars and automobiles, but also computing, AI and to build out digital infrastructure. And as you know, we all become far more dependent on our information and our data and our photographs all being stored in the cloud. You know, it's semiconductors that are required to help drive that digital infrastructure, which allows this to happen. Now, if we follow that through, then what does this mean for data centers and data center demand? I mean, we need to be build more resilience into the growth around our digital infrastructure in order to facilitate this demand for certain types of real estate. And given that 70% of global chip production has been dominated by those countries I mentioned earlier in the Far East, the US, as a result, have recently passed the Chips and Science Act in, I think it was 2022, effectively to allocate significant dollars to the production of semiconductors and chips within the United States, and also to fuel research and development, such that actually globally, we are less reliant on specific regions for critical parts of our infrastructure. So that's, I think, an example of how, you know, what we, the drive towards around globalization is sort of being slightly reversed, more in favor of adding slightly more diversification in our supply chains. There's one other example of where deglobalization has proved a tailwind for real estate is the onshoring and nearshoring of certain operations in Europe, in the US, from certain parts of Asia Pacific. And the UK is, I guess, is one example of that trend where, you know, manufacturing actually last year accounted for its highest share of logistics take up of any recent years. So, you know, that's an example, I think, of how that tailwind for logistics and the wider industrial sector is actually benefiting from deglobalization and supply chains slowly being more diversified. I mean, we don't expect to see manufacturing facilities shut down wholesale in one part of the world in favor of another. But I think what we are seeing is more diversification and more resilience being built into supply chains, which are ultimately tailwinds for real estate.
Mm. Yeah, fascinating. That whole deglobalization piece is really, really, yeah, something to keep a close eye on, as you say, Simon, and its implications for real estate. Yeah, I guess, obviously, you mentioned all the tensions geopolitically, but within the real estate sector itself, if we look sort of regionally, particularly in between the US and Europe, seems rather divided on the subject of net zero carbon emission targets. And your third megaforce is sort of the transition to low carbon. So how do you see that developing over the next few years, given some of the, shall we say, skeptical voices there are, over in America, if you like.
Yeah. Look, I don't think skepticism is limited by regions or countries.
Maybe generalizing too much. You're right. Yeah.
Everywhere. I think the trajectory for regulation and policy, you know, it won't be linear. Maybe Europe is slightly more advanced than other parts of the world in terms of internalizing the path to net zero. But ultimately, you know, these are global challenges that we're facing, and we need global policy alignment ultimately in order to tackle these. But look, I think you know, there's a widespread understanding now, I think, amongst investors that, you know, and let's use the term, so I guess, decarbonisation rather than ESG. I think, you know, decarbonisation is absolutely pivotal to creating value. And I think that is becoming mainstream in investors' thinking, albeit variable by market. But I think the huge scale of the challenge being faced by investors and occupiers around the uncertainty of regulation has probably made decarbonisation probably the most impactful value driver for the asset class. If not today in some regions, then it certainly will be over the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, there's a widespread realization now, in some parts of the world at least, that as an industry, we are way off track to meet net zero by 2050. Now, if we think about the built environment and its contributions to carbon emissions, yeah, it becomes no surprise to any of our listeners here that, you know, the built environment contributes circa 40% of energy-related carbon emissions. And now clearly that can be brought down quite significantly by decarbonizing the grid. But in order to reach, you know, the 1.5 degree goal from the Paris Agreement, significant industry change is still needed. And these are changes to how buildings are built, how they're operated, and how they're maintained. And given the debt-driven nature of real estate investment, there's also a critical role for lenders to also play in this transition. Look, you know, over the coming years, I don't think landlords are thinking anything other than making their buildings greener. But if they're not, then regulation will ultimately mandate this to happen. And as real estate investment managers, such as ourselves, you know, we are fiduciaries to our clients, and we have to understand that, you know, sustainability is a significant driver of value preservation and future growth and performance. So hence, as fiduciaries, you know, we have to be factoring the impact of decarbonisation, the growth opportunities, but also the depreciation opportunities that this has for our existing assets and our future products. So I suppose it might be quite helpful for our listeners to understand how we at BlackRock think about, you know, the impact on our current portfolio. And it is a hugely complex arena. Mm. So we've broken this down to effectively four areas. One, the impact on investors. Secondly, the impact on occupiers. Thirdly, the impact on lenders. And then fourthly, the impact that regulation will ultimately have on our strategies. So when considering the implications of this path to decarbonizing the built environment, we have to take this holistic view of the contribution to each of these essential market participants, that's investors, occupiers, lenders, and the regulators, you know, in order to build a holistic picture of what the true carbon impacts of our real estate exposure really is. And only when we've done that can we determine what the right course of action is, asset by asset. And ultimately, how do we price that? This isn't easy, but it's a challenge that we are all facing. And, you know, maybe we need a little bit more industry alignment here to help us tackle what is a common problem to every investor in this asset class. Maybe this is we can do a deeper dive, Marek, on a future podcast here, because I think, you know, these impacts are happening now, and we are seeing the green premium, or more often brown discounts, emerging across occupational and investment markets. So maybe that's a conversation to have next time.
Yeah, no, definitely, Simon. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as you say, it's hugely complex, and as things stand at the moment, the real estate sector appears to be way off track, as you said, to meet any sort of 2050 targets that are in place at the moment. I suppose another area where the real estate sector may be way off track is AI and digital disruption. I mean, that's sort of the fourth mega force that you mention. How do you see that influencing and guiding investment decisions? Is it something simply to keep an eye on a close eye on at the moment, or is it already having an impact?
Oh, I've been keeping a close eye on this for the last 25 years.
All right.
seen very little impact and very little change. But you know, I don't think we're quite at a place yet where AI is actually driving investment decisions. But I think the opportunity for it to do so today is absolutely vast. Mm. You know, it'll be some time until we see AI dominating in how we understand markets and market nuances. And, you know, as real estate players, you know, we pride ourselves on our human relationships and on our experiences. But I think as managers, as investment managers, develop their own proprietary, so large language models, and are able to reflect their own organizational nuances and USPs into their own models learning, then I think there is almost no limit to the ultimate longer term disruption that we could see in this sector from AI. I mean, we're already seeing some benefits and efficiencies in, you know, the underwriting of of opportunities, space utilization, building management, and the design and construction of developments. However, you know, when specific businesses have their own specific implementation of AI, you know, that will avoid us all having the same outcomes and us all chasing the same opportunities in the same markets, in the same sectors, driving greater bubbles than we've seen in the past. So I don't really see that as a risk in happening, because I think the large managers, the big investment managers, will be developing their own proprietary models that will guide their own thinking. Now, I think the future's really, really bright here. And I think we're entering an era where the reshaping of real estate investment and the disintermediation of long established relationships and processes can no longer be dismissed. I mean, I remember significant advancements in data exchange standards 25 years ago. Lots of talk about this is really going to disintermediate, you know, the real estate investment process. It will drive down costs of doing business. You know, we're entering a new world, you know, and here we are 25 years later, and not a massive amount of change has changed. I think if we look back on this situation in even 5 years from now, I think the situation will have changed quite considerably. So I think this is a really, really exciting area, and one that we need to stay very, very close to make sure that we're on the right side of the trend.
Yeah. Okay. And another area, the final mega force, if we like, is you call it the future finance. But as I understand it, that's not talking about particularly the future of financing real estate itself. You're talking about at a more street level, so households and companies, how they use money, how they borrow, etc. Is that correct, Simon?
It's quite an all-encompassing mm-hmm. term, actually, future of finance. I think firstly, you know, we all accept that we are now at the end of that great moderation of low interest rates, low inflation, and fairly steady growth. And, you know, we all expect, most of us expect, that interest rates will probably settle at much higher levels than we've been used to. But even those levels are still low relative to the historical level of interest rates. But it means in for our sector, you know, we can no longer rely on, you know, the drivers of performance that we have relied on in the previous cycle. And personally, having been through several cycles now, you know, I've always observed that it often takes a downturn or a recession to refocus investors back on the fundamental drivers of real estate performance, which is income and cash flow. And the drivers of income and cash flow and the drivers of occupier demand, what occupiers are looking for, is changing quickly. And it's changing as a result of the various mega forces that we just spoke about. But it's also the regulatory shifts that we're seeing. You know, we're seeing huge changes in financial architecture. You know, it's not just the end of zero rates, but technical innovation is changing rapidly. Which is really disrupting traditional business models. You know, banks, for example, can no longer rely on deposits just as the cheap, reliable source of funding that they once were. And we think banks will probably further rein in their lending, meaning companies are likely to turn to the capital markets for funding, private lending and non-traditional sources of credit. You know, there are also rapid developments in fintech innovation around payments, digital currencies, tokenization, and looping back to our earlier megaforce and AI. All these will combine and perform a role in how the financial system changes over time and how regulation and policy would also evolve, ultimately defining who those likely winners are likely to be. And it's important for us to be mindful of all of these changes and what it means for our asset class and, you know, for real estate and the alternative asset classes more generally. I think there's a huge opportunity to get ahead of these trends as the capital formation landscape changes in response to all these changes around how financial markets operate and work. And this isn't just the impact of demographics on DB as a source of capital for open-ended funds in the UK, and how we replace that with DC, how we provide a DC solution is obviously acknowledging the fact that the landscape is changing quickly. But I think that is simply just scratching the surface. So I think it's important that we have a framework for how we think about these issues and how they impact on the asset class.
No, absolutely. I mean, all of these mega forces could form standalone podcasts, but that's another one. There's so much to dive into, isn't there, Simon? And in terms of, well, everything from fintech to digital currencies to as you say, banks maybe stepping back, and then a lot of space being created in financial markets to fund businesses and real estate and what have you. Yeah, well, it's been fascinating and great talking to you, Simon. I'm sure we'll have to pick up again in a few months and delve into some more things. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. I don't know if you had any final thoughts, maybe to wrap up those five mega forces that you wanted to perhaps give us before we call it a day for today.
Yeah, thanks, Marek. It's been a rapid canter through our framework. But I guess the takeaway from this is that the pattern of demand is changing. And that change is being driven by the big mega forces that arguably we haven't had to focus on as key drivers of performance in the previous cycle. You know, these are the big structural changes that are now impact investing today and will impact differential performance in the future. And I think, you know, the key drivers of the new regime of macroeconomic and market volatility that we discussed, you know, they change the long-term growth and inflation outlook. And as we all know, real estate is a pro-cyclical asset class. When the macro environment is conducive to growth, real estate performs relatively well. But I think all of these changes will, you know, these aren't mutually exclusive. You know, they will combine to create major market dislocations and opportunities. And that is why I think it's so important that we have a clear framework for how we think about, how we assess, and how we price the impact of these forces to ensure we're on the right side of the curve and the trends. So it's about managing complexity. Complexity is risk. So it's critical that we're able to understand the complexity through a nice, clear, simple framework.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Simon. Fascinating talking to you and great to have you on. Thank you for your time.
Perfect. Thanks very much, Marek.